Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 2 of the Arcademia podcast with me, Kenny McNaughton, Jack Johnson and Adam Morgan. Today, we'll be talking all about the design process. So, lads, to jump straight into it, how do we define the design process? Easy one.
How do we or Reba? So, Reba defines it better than us. They define it as like stage 0 to 6, is it? 0 to 7?
I think there's a 7.
The business end is at 0 to 4, really. And each stage or number defines a different stage of the design process, but then each person has an individual style for process and whatever within them numbers.
So just on the Reba stages then, for those that don't know, take us through them quite quickly and just a quick overview of what you would be expected to do in line with that.
So stage 0, and I must admit, I'm not fully versed in 0 and 1. They sort of always just blend into 2, don't they? Yeah. You sort of start.
Well, zero and 1's the briefing.
0 is meeting the client and giving them a hug.
That's right, though. That's all I believe.
So you meet them, you ascertain what the brief is. Then 1 is getting your initial concepts down and responding to what their brief is. And then 2 is where it becomes a bit more tangible. So 2, as we define it, is like the pre-application process in a planning application. So that's when you start doing the majority of your work. And a lot of people don't do a lot of work at this stage, but we like to really front-end it, because the more you do, the more feedback you get. And it expedites then stage 3, which is the formal design process where you submit for planning. Yeah. Then stage 4 is like building regulations and, you know, starting to produce technical information.
Yeah. And then, yeah. Well, 5's on site then as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And then no one's really asked after 5.
6 is handover. Where they do like, we've done it once, haven't we? The lessons learned, sorts of stuff.
Yeah, so that's how Reba would define it. But in terms of a design process for the individual, not thinking about Reba, just thinking about the first time you get a brief from a client, where do you go from there?
So it does vary, really, doesn't it? Individual to individual. And me and Adam are totally polar opposites. So Adam likes to get as much down as he can in the first instance on the page.
Hold on, but we'll move on to that.
It's more so the stuff I've got down here is more, we start from a brief, but what's the design development? Is it a problem-solving process? So what do you do first? You get it in plan, you identify the constraints.
But that's what I was about to say.
Oh, so sorry, go on.
You, Adam gets everything he possibly can down, whereas I do a lot of thinking in my head at first. So I action a lot of the design process in the earliest stage in my head. So I'll be thinking like, ooh, precedence, you know, what I want the building to look like in the first instance, like, Is it a house for like £1 million? So where'd you take that? Or is it a mixed use apartment block? And the brief sort of dictates your first step.
So I think just taking it back a little bit, when you're saying about what is a design process, that was it, wasn't it? How would you define it? That has to be the first point, doesn't it? The brief. And everyone gets a brief, don't they? You know, whether it's uni or in practice, it always starts with a brief. I've actually seen a lot of architects use a brief in different ways. You know, as in like some people like to work outside the brief, they call it. I personally don't like to work too far outside the brief. I think you get more joy out of delivering what people are asking for, you know what I mean, like on the button. And then what you do is you try and tease, you know, kind of better options, you know, as you go. So you get given the brief and they'll have something in their mind. Tutors are like, we're more coming from a practice background, I suppose, here, aren't we, in terms of we're thinking of a client, a developer. But I'm just letting, you know, it does apply to tutors, this as well. They will have something in their mind, won't they, that they're thinking when they're given a brief. Same for developers. And I would say that, yeah, that's the first step. And I would say actually your first approach is to kind of create a list of how you're going to achieve that brief. Maybe draw a line under that and then say, And then, you know what? These are the things that could go beyond the brief. But rather than saying outside the brief, it's more beyond the brief. What can you deliver more than what do you expect?
It varies client to client as well, because some briefs will literally be how many units going to get on that plot of land. So then you have to go away and like appraise what type of unit would be suitable. Would housing even go on that plot of land? Could it be industrial? Whereas some will give you like a 50-page document outlining exactly what they want in it.
What's your preference? In terms of those two.
I prefer
polars.
A bit of a hybrid because it's a bit more rigid and you get a bit stuck if you just have a massive document.
That's why I said that, because I prefer the brief a little looser. Mm-hmm. You know, because we've got a, I won't name it because obviously it's confidential at the minute, but we've got a scheme in Bradford, haven't we? And the brief was phenomenal.
Yeah.
But you'd argue a bit too prescriptive, wouldn't you? It was a bit restrictive, if you like.
It takes away some of your creativity sometimes, doesn't it? If you're not allowed to stray from what is a very exact brief.
Yeah. Exactly. So then what we're going to do with the clients is we're then going to, in a nice way, we're going to kind of challenge some of those areas, aren't we? You know, we're going to say, well, you know what, have you thought of this? Have you thought of that? You don't necessarily need that, all that there and yeah. all that sort of stuff. So you're right, it's a hybrid.
It's sometimes echoing the brief back to them in your own hand, isn't it? And
absolutely. That's how you win a competition. We're talking about design process. That's a little bit of...
And it's like saying, have you actually thought of this and this? And sometimes they go, yeah. No, I haven't.
And obviously, the way you're figuring that out is through the design process. Yeah. So for you to challenge a brief or even to go along with it, you're then given the site that you're looking, yeah. 2D or 3D, however you prefer. And then from that, then you're identifying constraints. So if there's things in the brief that the client might want to see, but you can't for building regs or for planning reasons, you've got to then got to outline that, give them that back. And that is a very important part of the design process.
So the initial stage zero is like the first meeting. You do that. You try and ascertain at a high level what they want. And then stage one is like, okay, you've given me this site, but if it's surrounded and totally overlooked, it can be sterile, the whole site effectively. So then you then do have to translate that to a quick sketch.
Yeah.
To fire back and say, this is loosely where we're at. And then they normally challenge you back and then you keep going and keep going from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but just to try and make it a little more rigid in terms of what is the design process or what is the process. Number two, then it's analysis, isn't it? And and if you get a dead loose brief, as Jack said before, you're then kind of responsible for analysing the area. Is there an architectural kind of language in the area? Is there a scale and a mass and all that sort of stuff? So analysis. So brief number one, analysis number two, and that analysis should start to feed into a bit of a shape.
Like a feasibility, isn't it? So elaborating on a point I've just made, if like they give you a plot of land and it's in the middle of an industrial estate and they say I want housing, one, you can just say it's not really feasible, but it's easier to quantify it. So you normally, in Liverpool Council, for example, there's a policies map and 95% of the time it will be shaded a certain colour and just say this is for industrial use only. And then you just parrot that back to them and it's using the council to inform your bad news effectively.
Yeah, so schemes can end in the design process pretty quick at that analysis stage.
Not so much end, because it's our job to not make that happen, but we can basically say this isn't feasible, but this is. And then they go away then and reassess their options, the funding, the finance and stuff.
We've kept many a job alive, haven't we? That way.
Yeah. Well, another thing I wanted to ask was, just in terms of the timings of these things, you know, when does it go from massing to choosing a brick? You know, in your mind, when you're sitting at the desk and you've done your constraints, you've done your constraints drawing, you know what you can and can't get in terms of shape, size and that. You've got your shape sorted. Then do you start to mass that in then? Are you already thinking materials at that time? Are you thinking about precedents and getting those?
Varies individual to individual. So if you take Adam as a prime example yesterday, he's doing a housing scheme and he's already specking bricks on CGI.
No, I haven't specked a brick. I've knocked a little render off. I haven't. I suppose I have thought of the brick, haven't I?
Yeah, well, you must have, because you showed us an example chose a brick.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
Me, personally, I don't do that. I normally get you to pick me bricks, to be fair, don't I?
I'm the pallet guy.
But have you seen our office at the minute? It's full of bricks.
Yeah. But to answer your question about at what point does that kick in? Well, step three, I'm trying to give everyone a bit of a step-by-step thingy. So brief analysis, and I was deliberate in saying, sometimes you are left with a shape. We've got a project on a tapering scythe, and the resulting shape is quite attractive, isn't it? You know what I mean? So, and the shape is then kind of carved into with more constraints, overlooking heights. You've got different heights on different streets, so you can step things down. You know, I'm a massive believer of the site doesn't half speak for itself. You know, the thing can kind of design itself.
You lead me to another question.
No.
The site is the most important thing. You can't design in isolation. And we discussed this the other day, didn't we?
Can't design in isolation.
My question was, when you started talking about site, at what point do you have to visit site? How important is
straight
that?
Straight away.
Because in a world where now we deal with a lot of stuff on Teams calls or Zooms calls or other video software, we live in a world now where people tend to try and communicate more and more through technology and not in person. But physically being on the site is possibly the biggest part of the design process.
Yeah, but we've got a project in the Isle of Man, and we got planning permission before we ever visited the site. Now, that was COVID reasons. But it's possible. Yeah. It is possible. But then when we went, the cliff was about three times as big, wasn't it?
So then that changed the design process for you, in terms of then you had to then re-look at some of your aspects of your
what
design?
What it changed was how we thought of the views out, massively.
Yeah.
Because the scale of the context was a lot bigger
than
we thought. So it did, absolutely.
Yeah.
So ideally you do visit as soon as.
It's normally in the chronology, it's normally nice to visit the site before you try and design if you can, because you get a feeling what you want to do.
You do.
Straight
you
away.
You do get a bit of a feeling, yeah. But just going back to the thing, you know, at what point do you pick a material? For me, I think of materials at the point at which I start looking for precedents.
Yeah.
But I don't think of a precedent until I've done the first two steps. What's the brief? What's the... Jack's obviously touched quite heavily on use.
Yeah.
Is it going to be housing? Is it going to be industrial? That starts to make you think of a palette, doesn't it? It makes you start to think of a few projects.
Yeah.
And then you start looking at the constraints. That starts to form your mass and your shapes, all that sort of stuff. I think with those two in mind, I think then you can start looking for a good precedent.
Okay. Well, and your analysis informs the materials, because if it's like... If your site analysis shows that every single building in the area is like white Portland stone, no one's going to thank you for putting brick in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So,
so again, during the analysis, it can come out. What about other consultants and then bringing the rest of the design team in? So obviously architects take the lead at the forefront of a job. We carry the majority of the design on our backs, but then at some point we have to get those other consultants in to start feeding in structural, etc. At what point do you guys like to engage with them? Is that as early as possible, or is that more as when needed, like so it can come later when we're getting towards a planning application?
I'd probably answer that question differently now I'm more experienced. So in uni, fresh out of uni, I'd wanted all the help I could get at the earliest possible stage. But now with experience, I know loosely like what my road's going to look like, where I'm leaving service voids and stuff like that. So I can get them in a bit later. But probably when I was less experienced, like a year or so out of uni, I'd wanted them in straight away, me parking consultants and stuff, you know, to tell me parking spaces work. But now I sort of know. So I just get them to reaffirm it. And I'm making more tweaks rather than wholesale design changes.
Yeah, similar for you, or
spot on, to be honest. But one thing you touched on, or it might have been before this, we've rehearsed a little bit here, haven't we? is can they get in the way too soon? And I am a believer of that. I think if you can actually give yourself too many issues, you know, you can give yourself too many constraints to think of. You know, before you know it, you've got everything overlaid, structural grids, plant room, tanks everywhere, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. So before you know, you've got no building. Yeah. So there is too early. I think there is too early.
And like, for example, elaborating on that, if you've got every person's information at that stage, moving a wall can change like 50 drawings yeah. across all the professions, whereas
yeah,
so you just want to keep it to your own stuff.
And just in terms of once you're working with those consultants, if you get them in too early, is it sometimes difficult to then renegotiate? Where I'm going with that is...
So
sometimes, you know, your M&E contractor or your designer or your structural designer could come in and say, this is how we need to design it. But it is negotiable, isn't it? There's more than one way to engineer a building. So if you bring them in too early, does that tie your hands a little bit? Is it sometimes better to leave it later down the line?
Yes. No, so very, very, very... And again, I should say that this is all... our opinion. Yeah. this is all from our experience. We're just obviously explaining how we like it and how we've had success. And I have worked with engineers in the past. They aren't the most ambitious. And before you know it, your windows are, you know, 500 mil wide and, you know, what have you. So I prefer to have a concept of vision first. As Jack said, the more experience you get, the more that vision is realistic and the more that vision, you know, it becomes tweaks rather than changes. But nonetheless, I think at least give yourself 3 to 4 weeks to design something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Design something nice, design something quite creative. And then what happens is at least you're starting up here.
Yeah.
And then, yes, then the engineers can kind of start to... And when I say engineers, I mean all forms of engineers, mechanical, electrical, you know, plumbing,
highways
yeah. and then the obvious structural civil. It's nice to have a vision in mind. You can be quite cheeky and almost get a client excited by it as well. You know what I mean? Get them on side and then start to then maybe pare it back a bit and make it a bit more buildable, a bit more realistic. Now, obviously there are extremes there. You can't go mad. And then the client thinks he's getting a, you know, gold building. And then before you know it, it's not. So you gotta be careful with that. But yeah, I would rather get the consultants kind of working to the vision.
Yeah.
Rather than the other way around, 100%. Yeah.
And you mentioned client there. So are you informing the client of everything you do? Is this a day-to-day process or is it a week-to-week process? How often do you like them involved? So just... Because sometimes you'll need to deliver bad news. As you're saying there, you promised them something gold and someone tells you it can't be gold.
Yeah.
You've got to then speak to the client. So do you find it better to have them engaged every day or, you know, more sparingly than that?
Well, one little thing that we try and instill in our studio is on a Friday, isn't it? You know, what is it? Okay. Have a good weekend, then. especially with bad news. But no, I think daily you get nothing done. You know, we've had the odd client who comes in and they're over the shoulder going, "How are you getting on and all?" Like, you just can't get nothing done. I mean, I've actually melted down with like a dead basic drawing sometimes. You know, when someone comes in, I'm like, I can use this honestly. So. Weekly, I prefer it on a Friday. It gives you the full week to do your job, produce stuff, you know, produce some drawings, sketches, in my case, some 3Ds and what have you, and then you check in with them that week. I like to think that nothing too serious happens, you know, beyond that week, if you know what I mean. If there's an issue in that week and they're told on the Friday, you haven't left it too late,
yeah,
to kind of keep them in the loop and keep them on that journey. And I think a very, very good bit of advice for, you know, the design process with a client is you can actually kind of draw decisions out of the client so they become a bit of a designer as well. I think that's a bit of a liability thing, I suppose, in a way, but it's a good way of keeping them engaged, keeping them excited.
Yeah.
But it's also, it is a good way of, it sounds terrible, but kind of sharing the responsibility a bit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Again, as architects, we shoulder a lot of responsibility on what the design's going to end up looking like. But a lot of the time, whether you want to or you don't want to, you know, it is the old horse drawn by committee, isn't it? Because you will start with a lovely vision and by the time you get to putting it in for planning, the building looks very different to the way you Absolutely. Wanted it to look. And that's because of client decisions, whether that's to do with budget or, you know, or whatever. And then the same with all the other consultants that you have to feed into. They can change the building regularly, can't they, on the needs and requirements that they have. On planning, on we must talk about the
Let's
planning.
Let's not talk about planning.
We've got to. It's a very, very important, very important part of the design process. Explain, you know, for everyone listening, what it's like getting that pack ready, actually submitting it for planning alongside the client, and then what that process in managing that, like here at Liverpool, it's supposed to be 16 weeks, isn't it, that it's in the planning system for before you're supposed to get a decision.
It varies, yeah.
Yeah, but it can obviously vary.
Varies local authority to local authority, but the planning process varies based on the quality of planning consultant. So I would always recommend having a planning consultant because they have an opposite number in the council who they speak the same language as.
Yeah.
Whereas when we put it in, we haven't worked as a town planner. It's a totally different profession and people don't appreciate that.
But with this being about the design process, how specifically does the planning process impact the design process?
I must admit, I was getting a bit worried there that we were going to just go into like planning.
Want to get into the politics of planning, you know? Yeah.
Well, yeah, sort of, but there's a lot to be said about that. Yeah. And there's not all have to be negative. There are a lot of positives in a design, particularly in the design process. Sometimes you want the same as the planner and you actually use a planning response to help aid.
To get the client over the line.
Yeah. I'm glad then, because I just want to make sure we keep it on design rather than. Because I think there's an episode in planning, isn't there? The whole...
Yeah. No, so that is where I was going with it.
The predominant argument in planning is normally townscape and visual impact. So we always want tall stuff and planners want less tall stuff. And that's normally the loggerhead you hit, isn't it?
And I found that nationwide. Mm. I have found that nationwide. Height is probably the most disputed element, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of a scheme.
Yeah.
You know, you might have a corner site and you want to go up a floor, you know, to just emphasise the corner. And they would just rather it was the same height as the street.
Yeah.
It's so frequent, the argument on height, isn't it?
Yeah.
How many battles have we had now on height? It's crazy.
So when you're in for planning, you've developed your scheme with consultants, with clients, it goes in. The argument you're having is around scale, you know, townscape impact and stuff. Then it comes back out. Is it potentially a redraw at that point?
How do you
deal with the council's comments?
Just to pair it back, you normally have these discussions and dialogues at pre-planning.
Yeah.
So
a pre-app stage.
So you're not too involved in the process. So if you'd done it at planning, then you're bound by like the statutory time frames. So everything just has a massive knock-on effect. So they used to say, didn't they, you put it in for pre-app because it's good manners. But I think now it's a real important part of the process.
I'd actually say it's gone more important, hasn't it?
Yeah.
In the last 5 or 6 years. And what's nice is a lot of developers are understanding its value more now. Yeah. I say when we set up five and a half years ago, people used to think it was a waste of time, didn't they? They used to think it was getting in the way of the full permission. You know what I mean? Whereas now, as Jack said there, it flushes all that stuff out.
It's front-ending the onus on the design process when there's less riding on it because you're not into these big financial arrangements with lenders and stuff. So
Yeah. But it keeps it broad brush as well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You stay away from too much detail so you can deal with the bigger issues.
I'm just thinking about it. When we first started, there weren't really a pre-app, was there? You just used to put it in for planning?
Well, it existed. It existed.
It was free, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Is that the difference,
then? It was free, or it was a lot cheaper.
It was free, so you just sort of put it in for planning, didn't you?
Yeah. Just to explain to everyone listening who doesn't understand what pre-app is, it's basically you submit to your local authority to ask for pre-application advice. So you go in with a broad brush scheme, as Adam's just been alluding to. You're basically showing them a little bit behind the curtain of your designs, but you're not showing them the full designs. And you just want to get an understanding of what the council are happy with from a scale aspect. More often than not, it's just about scale.
And they'll feedback with informal comments, so you can't really hold them to them, but you're just getting a bit of a, is it all right?
Yeah.
And you're getting a yeah or a no, or basically.
But it does give you a sense of the appetite and all that sort of stuff. But I also got a sense from your question there, Ken, as well, that you actually wanted to get into a bit of detail. You know, what's the point of anyone listening if we're not giving them a few answers, if you know what I mean, in terms of a bit of detail. So you kind of, what you were sort of, correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like what you were getting at was if you get given a negative response, how do you deal with it? Is that roughly what you were what you were saying with height and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so again, just bringing it back to the design process, what does that mean for you guys? So you've put a scheme in, obviously the scheme that you always put forward, 99% happy with, aren't you? You've developed it with the clients and the consultants, so you're happy with where it is, and you're hoping that there's not too many comments coming back.
We've convinced ourselves it's the best thing ever.
Exactly. So then you get these comments back from the council or whoever it is, and you've then got to what? Redesign? You know, what do you go?
You
sort
of push the envelope of pre-app, don't you? So you'll make it as high as possible. You'll appraise it, you'll know the height, and then you'll go, let's go a bit higher and just see what we can get away with. And then they normally come back, and probably rightly so, as annoying as we find it, you have to justify it. You can't just put a really tall building on a site. So then the pre-app process now is normally split into like a couple of goes, isn't it? You don't just go in and get your response.
Meetings. It's split into meetings.
Yeah,
and on major schemes, they become workshops, don't they?
So now you're getting into plan and policy. So when you're talking about you have to justify the scale of your building and stuff, you can't just go in with a skyscraper. How big an impact does plan and policy have on your design process?
Well, we haven't answered your question though yet about what do you do when you get negative comments and all that sort of stuff. And it goes back to you asking about bringing consultants in. Again, what we've done the architect thing, what I have, and just called off loads of engineers. One massive one is like an urban design specialist. There are a few consultancies that we've worked with where they have like a heritage and townscape impact consultant, and they ground every decision on height in logic and policy and all that sort of stuff. So if your scheme isn't grounded that in the first place, then you've got no chance. So it's making sure that it adheres to these areas. And then, as Jack said, sometimes you do get a bit cheeky. You do play the game. I'm actually not a believer of it. I think planners see through that when you try and add two floors. I think they come back and say, we'll knock three off then, because we know what you're doing. So I actually would rather go in with the precise height it should be. Sometimes we're unable to do that because the developer almost pushes you into, because it's an old trick that used to work, it doesn't anymore.
Did it actually used to work? I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know. No, this is the thing.
It's like an old Liverpool tale, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, make it higher and they'll knock you down to the height we want.
But they don't.
You have to ground it in like heritage and townscape.
Yeah. And this is all policy, isn't it?
That's how you deal with it. So if you are a bit cheeky and they come back with certain comments, you either do exactly what they say, give yourself an easy life. You can't, you know, that has value because it saves time. And time is money in development, because there's interest rates and all that sort of stuff, which obviously is a prominent topic at the minute. Or you can challenge it. If you're confident that it's grounded in that logic, it should have been grounded in the first place, you can challenge it. You can go back and you can appeal a decision. You know, if you feel like it's going that way, and you can actually set up an entire design. You can actually set up an entire design and your language and everything that you're putting into your report. You can set it all up for an appeal if you strongly believe that.
Yeah,
you know, it'll be successful.
And we've been through that appeal process ourselves as a company, and we've won.
We've won every challenge we've gone in for.
We can definitely do an episode on that later down the line for anyone who's struggling.
As much as you're saying as well, it's policy. There are grey areas within the policy that leaves it open to subjectiveness.
Yeah,
and that's where the dialogue between your consultants and the planners, like consultants, is key.
Having good relationships where you can have informed discussions.
But in terms of back to a point we made before, if myself and Adam aren't urban designers, so we can't effectively argue that point, whereas an urban designer, our side of the table can. Yeah. And we just don't try now, do we?
And you mentioned the language that they speak as well. I've seen the difference sometimes a developer just hasn't got the appetite for fees, the consultant fees and stuff. So you mightn't have a planning consultant on board, and you feel a bit of friction, you know, with the planners when you're trying to be, you know, Mr. Architect, you be just snazzy designs and what have you. And because you're not portraying it in the kind of the way that they want to receive it, you just get that friction. As soon as you get a planning consultant in, and they're framing it in a way that the planner wants to kind of hear it, it just makes it a lot easier. Yeah. And that's kind of what you mean by the same language. It's, you know what I mean? They've got the same training, they've got that opposite number.
Yeah.
And it works well, doesn't it?
particularly in the north of England as well, there's not that many local authorities. So town planners, when they have worked for a local authority, they probably work for a few. So they generally know the planner for the council who they're talking to.
Yeah.
On a friendship level.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It always helps. Yeah.
So jumping back to precedence then, how important is that in the design process?
Go on, you put it lovely with. Well, precedence focused, isn't it?
It's key. So in uni, you'd sort of design a building and then you'd have to do like a report or whatever and you'd just pick precedence for the sake of it. But in reality, they really inform what you're doing because nothing's ever designed for the first time. So if I'm designing like a quite complex building or even a not complex building, I'll underpin my initial thinking in what precedence, like save what part of the building. So the chances are you won't just find a building that is your building. So you'll be like, oh, the windows on that one will work well and the brick on that one and the reveals. And you then put it all together on a bit of a mood board and then it starts just informing where you're going to take, you know, your thinking and your initial stages in the project.
Yeah, yeah. Now we're getting into the meat of it. and the thing with, the powerful thing with precedence, I think, and we touched on planners and all that sort of stuff. The powerful thing with precedence is it kind of convinces the viewer of it that it's doable. Honestly, the power of, you could do the most realistic CGI in the world and say, no, look, no, whatever. But when you show a successful precedence and say, this is what I'm kind of thinking and here's where it's been done well, it just gets them on board, doesn't it? Yeah. It gets them really thinking about the reality of
it. It's articulating the reasoning why as well. So we've had times in our office where we've just let like a part two run a whole report, you know, like a pre-app report or a DNA statement. And you find the language they use to justify the precedence is not really serving what you're trying to achieve. So it'll be like, this is a door and it's black. Whereas you're saying, I've chosen this door because blah, blah, blah. You know, you need to really apply critical analysis.
Well, on that basis, can precedence be dangerous? So can precedence sometimes lead you almost to imitate, almost, you know, so you've got to be careful in that.
You've got to be very careful.
If you're looking at a picture of something which you really like, sometimes you can struggle in the creative process not to move away from that and you get stuck on it and then you end up, by accident sometimes, designing the thing that's in front of you.
But that's where I think Jack's, and that's why I wanted Jack to go first, because I think he uses precedence the best in our office. And when he said about he cherry picks, you know, things for me, I think you automatically avoid plagiarism by just cherry picking elements.
Yeah.
Yeah. And people who are listening, the few hundred who were listening.
the 10 people.
Yeah. can rest assured that if you adopt that approach, you'll never be accused of it. And when Jack said there is no such thing as one complete precedent, for a scheme, there isn't. Yeah. There never is,
unless the site's identical, and that's impossible.
Also, exactly.
So the generally site informs speaking, it, doesn't it?
Like, yeah, exactly. So generally speaking, you'll almost never plagiarize because no two sites are the same. So you'll almost never. I don't get me wrong. You can. Yeah, of course you can. Of course you can rip something off. But what I mean is, if you do it properly and you go through the steps of brief analysis, all this sort of stuff, and then you cherry pick. I would say never more than three. So no more than three, because before you know it, you run out of, you know, you spread yourself.
A bit of a Frankenstein.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So, you know, so what one might be, as Jack said there, the openings in a building, that could inform, you know, that's one precedent.
Yeah.
The materiality could be another, and, you know, light and shadow could be another. Those three, if you then combine the best of those three and apply it to a site specific, you'll never plagiarise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it is dangerous ground. It is.
Yeah.
But I think if you follow the steps properly, I think you'll be all right. Yeah. That's how you design a building.
It's back to the saying from your favourite tutor in uni: nothing's ever new.
Nothing's new.
It's all been
that gave
done.
Me loads of confidence because I was nervous. When I was looking at precedence, and I learned in, was that, I think it might have been fifth or sixth year, wasn't it? We learned how to use precedence properly Don't worry if it's not. Just we learned how to use precedence properly. And then I got a bit nervous. And I spoke to a tutor and said, I'm nervous here that if I do that, that and that, I'll be copying. And he kind of just said, well, nothing's new. You know, a window is a window, you know, in a way. So it's just about applying a certain style that you've got inspiration from and applying it to your project. But as again, the key is as long as you follow the right steps, you can just plonk, you know, a Norman Foster building on a site. You can, if you wanted to, you'll get sued to high heaven, obviously. but you can do that. But you might say, I like Foster's Bloomberg building, and you might just say, you know what, I quite like the proportions of that.
Yeah.
And if I apply those proportions to this project, by the time you've gone through the process properly, you needn't know you've used that as a precedent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, it'd actually be an achievement to try and copy a building, wouldn't it? Because they just go to that architect. Because if you tried to copy it, it would never turn out like that.
No,
it'd be really difficult.
Yeah.
So I think I think naturally you wouldn't plagiarise. And just a little one I wanted to just mention was places to find precedents. Not everyone, I mean they might have done, but not everyone's heard of, say, Dazeen.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's the likes of Dazeen, Arc Daily. Can you think of any other
sites? It's being aware of what good practices there are out there.
Yeah,
because so if you go on Pinterest, they have like the same 10 buildings that everyone uses.
I wouldn't have said Pinterest.
So we don't really go on Pinterest. We've
discussed like local architects even, haven't we? Yeah. So you might not have to even be like big practices that you go and look at and see what they've done for proportions or reveals and things like that. It's even using your local ones and seeing what they've
done. There's a lot of quality local architects, and then further afield in London, where rather than just going on Pinterest, you sort of develop a bit of a black book of like which architects you're going to go to, and you sort of go from there, don't you?
Yeah.
So it's not everyone using the same precedents.
Yeah.
So, that's why I was sort of reluctant to say Dazeen as well, because that's like just a slightly more specific Pinterest,
it is.
So that's a great bit of advice then, isn't it? Get to know local, say regional in your region, and then get to know national firms. And then you might end up with a list of 10 firms. There's a few that I go to, websites I go to, like Macrina Lavington. They're very good. Percy and Company, Morris and Company. I've just reeled three off there. They're the websites that I'll always go back to because they're brilliant at what they do.
You just bookmark them in your Google search, so they're there effectively then. So
essentially, if you're in the design process and you're stuck, that's where you go, isn't it? You start going and just looking for precedents and things that you like.
And that's what they'll do as well in their practices. We've worked for big practices. They do the same.
Yeah. Be amazing to go on our website. and then where I was kind of going with the regional and the national, but more regional, you can then visit the thing as well. So I like the way you said that if you're stuck, let's be honest, there'll be a lot of people listening there are stuck now. You know what I mean? So this is, for me, this is amazing to kind of say, if you're stuck right now, and you learn about a few local practices, and then go and visit some of the buildings. You know, ideally, it's a bar or a restaurant or whatever. You know, within the building, go and just experience it, touch it. You know, you look like a weirdo, but go and just touch it and feel it and see how the light hits the building and all that sort of stuff. You won't be stuck for very long.
Applying that to uni as well, so a good tutor helps you in that process. So we used to like at the very start. It's daunting in uni starting a project, whereas the good tutors would say, look at this architect and this architect, or this building, and it then draws out to your mind, oh yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
I would say one of my favourite modules of uni was when they gave you a building to dissect, didn't they?
Yeah.
And mine was I think it's Stephen, it's Hodder. I think his name's Stephen Hodder, isn't it? It was a Stephen Hodder building. It was in, I think it was in Norway, and it was in this really remote location. And again, the way the light hit in, the way he designed it to let light penetrate really deep into the floor plate and all that sort of stuff. When they made you analyze just one building from, kind of start to finish and all that, it was absolutely, absolutely amazing. So again, if you're a bit lost, if you're a bit stuck, I would even And this is one of the reasons, it took us about half an hour to do a plug for academia. This is one of the reasons why our courses kind of result in a famous building, because there's nothing like replicating, actually drawing a famous building to just kind of understand it. You know, it's almost like reading a book cover to cover. You know, when you're drawing a building or you're modelling it in Revit or what have you, when you go through the same steps that someone else has gone through, in a way, I know you're not designing it, but you know, when you go through those steps, it really opens your eyes.
Well, in uni as well, we didn't so much look at other local architects or London architects. We looked at the President's Medal site. That was always a good start for us.
That's a great place.
You're talking about like the yardstick.
You're looking at your fellow peers and like the best fellow students in the country, what they're producing, and there's some amazing stuff on it.
I always think material websites as well. So like the Brick Bulletin, you know, like when you're thinking of materials, they always use their most amazing projects, don't they?
Rhine Zinc. So you've got me thinking there. Rhine Zinc is the leading zinc, or one of the leading zinc. They told me they're the leading zinc manufacturer.
And, there's a plug for Rhine Zinc.
More sponsors to go and call it Noodles and Monster from last Saturday. This will just be sponsors.
That's what we're going for, aren't we? That's a great point though. These top material manufacturer type places, they're only pushing the best uses of their own materials, aren't they? So even something as you think as basic as a brick, if you go on the Brick Bulletin's website, they'll go, "Oh, look, that's how you can use bricks in a really interesting way." So that's good. So again, what we wanted to achieve here is trying to inform people how we design, isn't it? How we go through these steps. And how long have we just spent there on precedence? Yeah. It's so important. And obviously we've been very careful in saying you don't plagiarize. But before you move out of massing mode, you've got to go for a precedence.
Interesting question then. Zaha's football stadiums or the Singapore airport, things that are totally new. Mm. You know, you talk about everything's been done before. The bird's nest at the Beijing Olympics, these types of developments, massive developments, do you think they started with precedence?
Yeah, 100%.
It started with precedence, but it's also based on research and analysis. You know, a lot of initial big architectural moves are based on analysis and constraints with the site, or it might even just speak to a cultural you know, sort of thing in the area.
Or they're inspired by something. So the bird's nest is inspired by a bird's nest. The football stadiums in Qatar, one of them's inspired by the ancient huts they used to use, isn't it? And it sometimes your precedent is in the form of inspiration from nature.
That's what I was just going to say. So your precedents aren't always, in fact, buildings.
Yeah.
It could be something that just takes your eye and
me and Adam have had a little romantic stroll around the bird's nest, haven't we?
Yeah, actually. We went travelling around China, didn't we, for a month.
And materiality is another one, you know, in terms of, you're talking about analysis and research. There's a famous building in Liverpool called the Spine Building. And I know a lot of research went into the materials used in that building make for better health for the users of it. And it's about air circulation, and it's about about the wind, the glass that they've used, the fenestration and stuff. So even that sometimes can be a massive part of the design process, can't it? In terms of what you want to achieve out of the building, only certain materials can fit.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And it's weighing form v function up, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'd put all that under the heading of research, then, wouldn't you? Precedence or a branch of of research. But that's a good question, and in terms of. If you are without a precedent or if there isn't an applicable precedent, then you need to think a little bit more out the box then. And what is the kind of the vernacular telling you?
Yeah.
And there will be something eventually. That's why I say Everett and I design is site specific. Yeah. And you will find something. And it might be harder to find, absolutely.
Just to touch on a quick one, recently in our office, a site that we're looking at, when we went through the historic maps a couple of weeks ago, we found out that adjacent to the site was Liverpool's first ever zoo. And just that, even there, even going through historic maps and seeing what used to sit on that site that may no longer be there. Liverpool was heavily bombed in the Second World War, so we lost a lot of buildings. But things that used to stand there, bringing old form and shape back to a site can sometimes be a good precedent.
Historic analysis is an easy win. No, it's a bit of an easy win, that one. If you can bring old massing in or a bit of a nod to the form that used to be there, planners eat that up.
It was generally done better historically, wasn't it?
Yeah. But you can do it in a modern way. Yeah. Can't you?
Well, have you seen, I'm sure, doing the rounds on the socials lately, the company that started to reinstate buildings using drones to show what they used to look like. And if you haven't seen that, definitely check it out.
Gaudi's Cathedral in Barcelona.
So you check that out. But things like that, definitely going back through historically what the site represented and maybe bringing that scale and form back.
Well, there's a site we're looking at elsewhere in Liverpool, and we did conclude that it was bombed to high heaven during the war. So what it led our analysis to conclude was there could be unexploded ordnance under the site. So
it could
save your life, couldn't it?
As well, yeah.
Proper research.
Yeah.
So just take it easy. And I'm kind of telling myself this, but you know, you do your research, and the design will kind of come out the wash, I suppose, in a way. Again, if you follow the 5-point plan.
So that covers probably that the early stages now then. I'm worried for time here, by the way, so I want to try and get towards the other points.
Yeah.
But moving a little bit more quickly, because a lot of the heavy lifting with design is done in that stage, zero to your plan and permission isn't zero to the end of three. Moving into four and five, it's into the detail, isn't it? So it's not so much that the work's easier, because it's probably in a large part more time consuming.
It's collating all the information, but it depends on how thorough you've been in stage 0 to 3. So if you haven't got all the consultants involved, you then have to go and redesign it, because you find a lot of it doesn't work. Yeah. So by introducing it early, you put yourself in good stead for the rest of the project. Whereas if you don't work out like your fire escapes and stuff early on, you're then in effect having to redesign elements of the building.
Yeah.
And then you have to go in back in for planning under a section 73.
Well, not even that. I'm more thinking once you start getting into technical design, your scale changes. So you're going from working on a site-wide or floor plans to looking at details into your 1 to 20s, into your 1 to 5s.
Well, you probably go at the scale we're probably at no more than 1 to 100 for planning, aren't we? We may call out some more zoomed in elements where we need to, but I'd say you generally don't go above 1 to 100 for planning.
50. Call it 50 sometimes.
50 for smaller projects.
Yeah.
You'll maybe call out individual apartment types if it's a residential scheme at 1 to 50. Then your starting point at stage 4 is probably 50, 20, 10, 5, 2.
Yeah. But before we get into that, I actually did quite like what Jack was touching on with the better job you do of stage 3, say, the easier you give it, you give it yourself in 4. That's so important. That, and something that's been doing my head the last couple of weeks is I've been accused of, you know, if another architect's picked up one of my jobs and they've sort of said, oh, it isn't fully resolved and all that sort of stuff. Sometimes you're not able, are you? Sometimes the project hasn't had the budget maybe for the full team. Mm. Or what have you. And when you do get into stage 4, and if elements are unresolved, it's lethal. Yeah. It really is lethal. You're having to go back in for planning and all that sort of stuff. So I'd strongly urge everyone to kind of encourage the clients or whoever to do that. Just go that extra mile in the first steps. For planning, get everything kind of zoned out. You know what, your server zone, your structural grid. Get all that at least in the right sort of areas, so that you avoid a planning resubmission or an amendment. They call it, but an amendment takes ages as well.
Yeah.
And a section 73 is a variation of a condition, which is the condition with the drawings listed. That's all that is. Mm. So you're trying to replace the drawings with a new scheme, but the planners will see through that, and it takes forever. As architects, we've only got so much influence on that, but as much as you can do, definitely push. We're pushing harder now, aren't we, to get clients to just buy into that full team mentality.
Yeah.
You know, for planning stage.
It saves you money in the long run, doesn't it? Everyone involved.
What is it? Measure twice, cut once.
Yeah.
It's literally that. Yeah. But then to answer your question a bit more directly, how I tackle the design process for stages 4 and 5 is I break it down by scale. It is quite as simple as that. And then the scale of the drawing determines what goes on it.
Yeah.
So if it's a 1 to 50, it's overall setting out. And broadly speaking, it's my little thing I'd say to everyone in the office is about getting into the mentality of colour coding everything. So colour code, if it's in plan, you're setting walls out, you're setting openings out, give every wall a colour code, give all the windows and doors a label, and in all that, identified then on what's called a general arrangement drawing. Mm. That's your 1 to 50, even 1 to 100, depending on the scale of the job. And then if you move that into a 1 to 20, then what more do you need to show then at 1 to 20? And then it would be kind of the breakdown of the wall, wouldn't it? And how it interfaces with other junctions and all that sort of stuff. So scale is an amazing thing. And if you write all that on a drawing list, and ideally you're thinking of it in a kind of tapering scale, it really clarifies how you're going to approach it.
And it's important what you show on drawing, so you can't show everything because then you show nothing.
Yeah,
so,
it's too complicated. So
a drawing should show like one or two things maximum. If a drawing doesn't make sense, it won't make sense. Yeah.
Like if it doesn't make sense, it won't make sense.
Yeah. Sometimes we've had a drawing and maybe what's been done in-house or by another architect, and you look at it, you don't understand it, and that's not the point of a drawing. The point of a drawing is to have fewer bits of quality information rather than everything.
So in terms of how that helps a builder on site, would you sometimes say it was an apartment type? You could draw that apartment type four times because each of those times it would be showing something different. It would be showing a different piece of information rather than putting all of the information for that one apartment on one sheet.
So not even necessarily like using an apartment type as an example, looking at the building as a whole, if you give someone a drawing that's just got the partitions on, that will go to the partition contractor and he doesn't care about what couches and stuff.
Yeah.
It'll just confuse him. So you just you break it up per trade effectively, don't you?
Yeah.
That comes with a bit more experience, though, doesn't it? Understanding the trades, like external doors would go to the same company as the windows, but I didn't inherently know that straight away, you know what I mean? So the things like that. So that comes with a bit of experience. But that's literally how you break down a technical design as well. Scale's, I think, an easier starting point for a newbie. And then the subdivision of that is then the building elements, which are categorized, aren't they? So there's external walls, internal walls, doors, ceilings, and then you break all that down. And then before you know it, it actually does really simplify it, and it calms you down, that overwhelming feeling of, you know, I've got to do 100 drawings. But actually, you know, say, Jack, if you make each one of those drawings as simple as can be, and you're being very confident in what you're showing in each one, you don't off, you know, work through
it's
them.
It's like thinking of it like so if someone's struggling to understand what we're trying to say, think of like a house made of Lego. You just take it apart and put all the windows in a pile. You put the base in a pile. You put the walls in a pile. And you're splitting it out into its component parts so it's easier to build back together, in effect.
And then step one is it can then be priced easier by tendering contractors. And in the same breath, it can be built a lot easier as well.
Yeah. The thing you said on when we were walking up here, which I absolutely love and I think it's very simplistic, is think about what the drawing's trying to say. Mm. What are you trying to communicate with that drawing? And then draw it. You know, like when you draw it in that mindset of if someone asks you, send me the internal wall build-ups, then you just focus on sending them those, you know, you're not trying to say too much.
Exactly. It doesn't need everything else. And so you're spot on there in terms of think about what you're trying to achieve first.
Yeah.
And then you'll have a very clear vision then of what you're trying to draw. Yeah. And then just a quick one as well, just on the technical design is also a point at which the design doesn't end. Everyone thinks design is just like the vision, the concept and all that sort of stuff. But actually the way a ceiling hits the top of a window frame and all that sort of stuff, you know, that those little elements can make or break a job as well. So the design can never end.
Nowhere.
It's the delineation between like stage 4 technical design and 5 construction. A lot of the stuff you can't fully resolve at stage 4 because you haven't got like a window manufacturer on board who you've paid, so they won't give you endless time. They'll just give you some principles to put on your drawing.
Yeah.
And then once you get to stage 5, once they're on the team and you've paid them, like windows and cladding, then you can really hammer home the detail of it.
Yeah, so that's it, isn't it? You're essentially drawing in stage 4 some generalities to get a tender out so that
you're
then
setting zones
all the contractors
effectively to
then bid, don't they?
To fill yeah. later
and
on.
And they have their own supply chains.
So then
they'll
when
give
they,
you the very specifics.
When
then.
The winners in each area of the tender win that contract, that's when then you can start finally getting to the final design then, like of what is actually being built on site.
Yeah. And even when it's on site, you're still getting
queries
bits
and things
bobs.
Are going, yeah. No job's ever perfect.
No, exactly.
Well, we've got an example of that in the office at the moment where we're detailing like a frameless glass balustrade, but in another complex system. And the QS has said, leave the drawing quite general so I can go out to loads of different suppliers. Whereas if we just commit to one at the moment, we're tied into their
the
system.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. No, so I think at the end of stage five, you know, that you've described the design process there and defined it quite well.
And by the way, we have got on Arcademia, whether you purchase it off Andor or you're a member and you've got access to it, in the Architects Toolkit, there is an example project folder with Everton in that we've discussed.
Yeah. It's a good head start.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. I think you've defined and you've explained it very, very well there. But as with anything, especially with creatives, it differs from individual to individual. So I work with you two every day and I see the differences in you. Jack is very methodical in his design process and you like to get things in 2D first, plan, you know, you're drawing it out, sometimes sketching, quick options and stuff. Whereas Adam, you're very much more, you want to visualise it in 3D as early as you possibly can. And then you get the concept design to a really high level really quickly with loads of detail in it sometimes. And then you can work backwards from there.
But at that point, a lot of my stuff is unresolved though.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the point I was saying earlier about sometimes you don't get the opportunity to fully resolve your scheme for a million and one reasons. But for me, I get a bit of, I don't know, I relax more when I kind of get a bit of a sense of the end goal.
Yeah.
So mine's a psychological thing.
That's exactly what I wanted to get drawn out of that was, what are the benefits to you doing it your way and you doing it your way? Because there'll be a lot of people who will listen to this who will be like, well, I like to design this way. And I think most people sit either in between you or one side or the other.
There's no one size fits all. If you don't know Adam and you're working alongside him for the first time, it can be quite intimidating watching him because you'll both spend a day doing something and I've like done a few sketches and he's modelled the full building.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But you end up getting to the same result.
So a day there's a big difference, but in 4 weeks there's none.
Yeah.
Is there? Four weeks there's none. Because what I do is I race to the finish line and then I'm constantly iterating then to get back to a level of accuracy that he's started with.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
So I'm probably a little bit calmer and less, I don't know, is that the right word?
No, I think it is. I think calmer. You're the calming influence in the office. You're the adjudicator between me and him. And he's the calming influence. I'm the mad one who runs around everywhere. And that's how I design. I try and get it all. I try and get, spew it all out on the page as early as I can. But as I say, for me, it calms me down. And so I'm in pure panic mode for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Right. Just get it all out. But then once I can see it all in front of me, I then go, okay, that needs that. That needs that. You know, there'll be a lot wrong in what I'm doing, but I know it's all savable.
Yeah,
do you know what
I
mean? I know it's all kind of there.
Whereas,
and then I chip away at it.
I feel like it's never wrong.
It's never wrong.
It takes a long
but
time.
But it takes
to
four
get
times
the
amount of time.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'd say the analogy of our personalities is you're like a V12 engine who needs a lot of fuel and you're like, you need a lot of coffee, whereas I'm like a sailboat.
Yeah.
Just cruise.
Just ticking over.
At a slower pace. So you'll get to the just before the finish line a lot quicker, but then you'll run out of fuel and you'll have to fill up.
Then
I'll get there at a slow pace.
We'll
cross at the same time.
Yeah. It's the tortoise and the hare. But almost a draw. No, you don't win. I suppose that'll give a level of comfort that to some people because when you're in university, you can't doubt yourself a lot. And Adam, you told us a nice story before we come on here where you were saying about in university, you were given a project. You've done it in a week when you have 4 weeks to do it.
Yeah.
You consider it finished. So then what the tutor's done to you and or like clever clogs, you've got 3 weeks to go and do something else then.
Do another
and
one.
And then you have to do another one. And in the end, you've designed four schemes where if you just take your time on that one, stretch it out,
But that doesn't serve Adam's personality. So It's a mental thing, isn't it?
Which is a great point about a little flaw in uni, if you like, is they do try and do a one size fits all a little bit. You know what I mean? They think of President's Medal winners and go, well, they want everyone to be like that.
Yeah.
Whereas what they should have done with me, rather than telling me to do another scheme, they should have actually picked out the bits that were unresolved and the bits that, you know, were resolved as well, because some of it's resolved, but actually then chipped away at that.
Yeah, and told you to drill down further.
Yeah,
it makes sense. And hopefully that's given people comfort that there's more than one way to do it.
There is more than one way to do it, but there's a bit of an anxiety point for me.
Yeah.
I get a new job, I'm dead anxious until I see something.
Yeah.
Whereas actually it's not productive. If I was to pick a better way, I'd say Jack's is the better way, to be totally honest.
Yeah.
I'm not being modest, nothing like that. You do your best work when you're at ease.
Mm.
And I'm very rarely at ease,
yeah.
Honestly. So the best way to do it is to be at ease. Try and just relax a bit and just take your time. Don't panic. You know, we had days at uni where you produced nothing and you would accept that, wouldn't you? You would accept it with grace and go, I'll come back to it the next day. You'd sit on it, you'd think on it, and the next day you'd have it all answered in your head.
Yeah.
Whereas I couldn't get to bed unless I drew something.
You'd stay up all night drawing 10 different buildings.
Exactly.
It's just the mind thing.
Yeah.
I'm not saying completely avoid your natural instincts as well, but just try and give yourself a bit more.
No, that's good. And you mentioned in uni there. So we've been in practice life for a while now. So our ideas of the design process are very much geared towards that, working with clients, working with other consultants and stuff. But think back to the time when you were in university. What are the differences going through the design process at university compared to now with practice life?
Well, it's program versus narrative, isn't it? Is the key one.
Yeah, there's less need for narrative. I think there's still a need though. I think that you can still, or you can actually put a narrative in yourself. You can make it, you know, have a purpose. But that is the main difference. At uni, you score. And so, you know what, actually, I'm doing what you said before. This is Jack's point. I'm going to let him say it.
I forgot now because you've just hijacked.
Sorry. So this is for everyone watching. This is Jack's show that I've nicked off him.
No. So in
go on, you score big, don't you?
In uni, it's all about the narrative. So you front load a lot of your thinking into the narrative. Whereas out of uni, it's more about the program and what people need in the building, and that probably just edges the narrative, doesn't it? In reality, and then. You do marry the two together, but in uni, they're less bothered.
So let me just try an example and tell me if I'm way off the mark here. But in university, you might have to be designing something that's quite sustainable. You might come up with a narrative around bees, and you might go, the whole ground floor, first floor, is dedicated to creating beekeepers and generating honey to the world. But then when you come out, there's no chance of your building something like that.
To quote Adam, the narrative is the problem the building is solving.
Yeah,
next
one. Yeah.
There you go. I credit you up front.
But there is less of a need of it in practice. There is less of a need of that, you know, the building is trying to create, you know, a hydrogen fuel lab or something like that. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're incredibly rare in reality.
Whereas
at uni, you can kind of carve that out for yourself, can't you?
Yeah.
You can carve that brief out for yourself and say, that's what I'm trying to achieve.
The narrative is normally the brief because someone needs to make money from the building. So they come to you and say, I need to create hydrogen fuel. And the narrative sort of is preformed for you a little bit. Whereas in uni, you score by forming it yourself.
Yeah, they want you to come up with the narrative on your own, don't they?
Yeah.
And have that sort of that blue sky thinking, that thing that hasn't been done before.
Mm.
Whereas when you're in the real world, you're constrained by technology and you're constrained by budgets. So you have to build to what's available, don't you? So you haven't got that level of blue sky thinking.
Yeah.
And it's more constrained. It is a bit more realistic and all that in practice. But then the opportunity you've got in practice is, you can still, you know, you're big on proportion and stuff like that. There are still a million and one architectural moves available to you in practice. It doesn't mean it's the end of the design.
Yeah.
By no means. You've just got to be a bit more pragmatic about it and still have half an eye on the commercial aspects. But you can still produce something really, really nice on a tight budget, 100%. If anything, I think that's more creative, isn't it? It's more creative to come up with something in a tight space on a tight budget than just endless everything.
Yeah. And in reality, it's buildability. So in uni, you can do a building carved into a cliff that you can't get to and can't build, but you have to factor that in real life, like health and safety and stuff. Like, as much as it's boring, you do have to factor it in, and logistics and, you know, it's the key differences, aren't they?
Good answer. So let's move into our Q&A from our watchers and listeners. So we've had a question in from one of our members who wants to know, nice and easy, your favourite architect and your favourite scheme.
I'm going to struggle with that one because I can't really answer it in one sentence or in one person. So I'd probably say, broadly speaking, my favourite is Le Corbusier. I love the brutalism and, you know, everything he's about, his ethos and stuff. My favourite building of his is Unite the Habitation, because he totally rethought how to combine a house, housing use and mixed use and within one building. It was in effect a city within a building. But I don't know if he is my favourite architect and my favourite building, because then you've got like Rem Koolhaas, who I like different architects for different things. So I like Rem Koolhaas because I like the way he portrays his information, his model making and his drawings. And then, you know, Richard Rodgers, I love the Pompidou Centre. I'd struggle to pick one. Mies van der Rohe, you know, less is more. He paired it all back from all like the really intricate stuff.
He's leaving none for me.
Leaving an architect with Adam.
Just while I'm flowing, because I didn't think I'd think of any on the spot.
Let
me go for my favourite local architect then, because all the obvious ones are obvious, aren't they? So we get a lot of inspiration, I do, from Tim Groom. Is he based in Manchester?
I think Manchester based.
So I really like a lot of the stuff he does, and not naming a building in particular, but he has a certain style. So when you see a building, you know it's his by the high quality brick and the detail. And so
it has a language, doesn't it?
I'll go for Tim Groom. I won't go for an obvious Le Corbusier.
Nice.
Official answer, Tim Groom.
Mine's dead cliche. But I love the way we have prepared for this one a little bit. You know, we got the question a few days ago, didn't we? And we thought that's a nice little one to start us off with and stuff like that. And we had a little chat this morning, didn't we? I love the way you remembered the one architect, because everyone thinks it's Foster, you know, everyone in the office, I always call on Foster and all that sort of stuff. But the one architect I always went back to at uni was Ando, Tadao Ando.
And Lieberskind.
And Lieberskind, yeah. But yeah, deconstructivist's gone a little bit out of fashion now. But Tadao Ando was always the one I went back to. He was the first book I bought, the big, massive Taschen one. He's the guy I always went back to. My final uni building was just raw concrete, you know what I mean?
So I love
Ando because I mentioned it a little earlier on about the play with light and shadow, and all, he's the master. He's absolute master. Church of Light.
That's why I'm a brutalism guy, because I'm all about the light and shadow, but I won't get a brutalism building over the line in Liverpool.
We do a couple of competitions a year. It's our chance to flex a little bit, isn't it, in terms of we'll do what we want. We'll have a go. We mentioned brief and all that. We'll just do our own brief and all that sort of stuff, right? But yeah, I love him. I love buildings that you can kind of touch and feel, and you know what have you, and you know when the light hits the wall at a different angle and all that, it says something different every time and stuff. And for me, Ando is the absolute master of that. And so then to stay on Ando, my favourite building is the Church on the Water, which is one of the best contextual buildings that is. And all the way through this, I've mentioned about how, you know, the site lets the building, you know, it kind of designs itself and what have you. And that Church on the Water is, although it is concrete, don't get me wrong, you know, you can see, you can't miss it.
Yeah.
But the way but it's formed with the landscape. It's got loads of like half interior, half exterior spaces that all interact with the landscape around and all that sort of stuff. It's about as site specific as a scheme gets. So for me, he's always the guy I go back to, and that project is pretty much how I would like to design anyway.
It sounds lovely, and the reality of my architecture porn when I'm browsing is Soviet brutalism, but I am not doing that here.
You do well on TikTok, the brutalist posts. So people like it.
That's my favourite style, but obviously it's quite it's quite polarized. Well,
Ando's quite brutalist, isn't he? It's all very.
Is it an architect thing? The non-architects not really get
so,
it.
So when I say to my wife about my proper end goal, my proper dream as an architect is to do my own house. And all I show her is just polished concrete floors, panel form concrete walls, and she just goes, no. Absolute no.
Definitely an architect.
It is an architect.
No more. That's it now. We've had enough.
Another good like non-world famous one is Strom Architects. They're quite...
I love them.
Yeah, they're good, aren't they?
Good Instagram.
Look, you could name architects all day. So the answer is your favourite, and we like to keep Q&A snappy.
So we've done the whole design process.
So
we've
my favourite eight we've got.
He took all my answers last week, or last month, whatever it was.
I give you credit.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time for this one. I think we could have gone for another hour there, to be honest. But
easily.
But we've run out of time for this episode. As always, thanks for joining us. Check us out on our website, academia.com, all our socials, which will be tagged below this video. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next one.